This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Closer Than You Know by Brad Parks. Read for you by Emily Rankin. Chapter 1. He was dressed in his best suit, the one he usually reserved for funerals. She wore pearls. It made her feel more maternal. Arm in arm, they walked up a concrete path toward Shenandoah Valley Social Services, whose offices filled a cheerless metal-sided building. There was no landscaping, no ornamentation, no attempt to make the environs more inviting. As an agency of county government, social services had neither the budget nor the inclination for such gilding. Its clientele was not there by choice. The man paused at the front door. "Remember, we're perfect," he said to his wife.
"The perfect couple," she replied.
He pushed through the door, and they traveled down a stark cinderblock hallway toward the main waiting area. A sign read, "Notice, no weapons." The room they soon entered was ringed with blue imitation leather chairs and stern warnings against food stamp fraud. A smattering of people, all of them luckless enough to be born into multi-generational poverty, looked up and stared. Men in suits and women in pearls were not a common sight here. Ignoring them, the man and woman crossed the room and announced themselves to a receptionist who was bunkered behind a thick chunk of clear plastic. This could be a tough business. The administering of benefits, the denying of requests, the dispensing of abused and neglected children, taking them from one family and bestowing them on another. There had been incidents. After a minute or so, the man and woman were greeted by the family services specialist who had been assigned to them, a woman with a tight ponytail and square-framed glasses who received them warmly, by name, with hugs and smiles. It was all so different from when they had first met her, about 3 months earlier, when it had been nothing but dry handshakes and justifiable suspicion. Families like this didn't just stumble into Shenandoah Valley Social Services and volunteer to become foster parents. Families like this, who had resources, connections, and that air that suggested they weren't accustomed to waiting for the things they wanted, either went with private adoption agencies or traveled abroad to acquire their babies. Eastern Europe if they wanted a white one, Africa, Asia, or South America if they didn't care. "Seriously?" the family services specialist wanted to ask them. "What are you doing here?" But then she started talking with them, and they won her over. They told her about the failed efforts to get pregnant, then about the tests that revealed they would never be able to have children of their own. They still wanted a family, though, and they had decided to adopt locally. Why go overseas when there were children in need, right here in their own community? They were just looking for a vessel to receive their love. The family services specialist tried to explain to them there were no guarantees with this route. It might be months or years before a baby became available. Even then, they might foster the infant for a time and then have to turn it back over to its birth mother. Adoption was always a last resort. Social services' goal, to say nothing of Virginia statutes, prioritized reunifying children with their biological families. The woman chewed her fingernails when she heard this. The man seemed undeterred. After that initial interview had come the parent orientation meeting, then the training sessions. They had taken notes, asked questions, and generally acted like they were trying to graduate at the top of the class. Their home study, in which every aspect of their residence was inspected, had been flawless, from the child safety locks all the way up to the smoke detectors. And the nursery? Immaculate. A crib that exceeded every standard. Diapers squared in neat piles. The walls freshly covered in blue paint. Blue? The family services specialist had asked. What if it's a girl?
I have a hunch, the man said.
They flew through the criminal background check. Their pay stubs showed ample income. Their bank statements swelled with reserve funds. Home insurance, check. Car insurance, check. Life insurance, check. Their physician had verified that both the would-be mother and father were in excellent health. Their references gushed with praise. In her 13 years on the job, the family services specialist had interacted with hundreds of families. Even the best, most loving, most well-meaning among them had issues. This one didn't. She had never met two people more ready for a child. They were the perfect couple. Shenandoah Valley Social Services did not officially rank potential foster families, but was there any question about who would be number one on the list if a baby became available? Even now, here they were, turned out like they were attending an important public ceremony, when really they were just going back to a shabby, windowless office to accept a piece of paper. It was their certificate, indicating they had completed the necessary steps to become approved foster care providers. They beamed as they received it. They were official. More hugs. More smiles. The receptionist came out of the bunker to take pictures. It was that kind of occasion for this couple. Then they departed. What if we did this all for nothing? The woman asked as she walked out of the building. We didn't, the man assured her. You really think it's going to happen? He leaned in close. Don't worry, he said. We'll have a baby in no time. Chapter 2. If you are a working mother, as I am, you know this truth to be self-evident. Good childcare, safe, affordable, and reliable, is rarer than flawless diamonds and at least twice as valuable. It is the connective tissue, the breath in your lungs, the essential vitamin that makes all other movement possible. The flip side is that losing your childcare, especially when you have an infant, is basically incapacitating. That was the catastrophe I was trying to avert on a Tuesday evening in early March as I sped toward Ida Ferncliff's house with one eye on the road and the other on the clock, which was ticking ominously close to 6 p.m. Mrs. Ferncliff had been watching our now 3-month-old son, Alex, since he went into childcare at 6 weeks. With children and babies, she was as magical as Harry Potter, patient and kind, caring and calm, unflappable in all situations. With adults, she was more like Voldemort. My husband, Ben, referred to her as Der Kaiser, after Kaiser Wilhelm, and not just because of her mustache. She had her rules, which she followed with Teutonic precision, and she expected everyone else to as well. One of them was that children should be picked up by 5:30, no later. She had a 15-minute grace period, though Mrs. Ferncliff's idea of grace was pursed lips and a nasty glare. After 5:45, she fined you $20, plus a dollar for every minute thereafter. Picking up after 6 was cause for termination. That was in the contract that I, Melanie A. Barrick, and my husband, Benjamin J. Barrick, had signed. And Mrs. Ferncliff had made it clear she would not hesitate to exercise the after 6 clause the last 3 times my shift replacement, the contemptible Warren Plotts, had ambled in more than a half hour late, sending me on mad dashes against the clock that had me arriving at 5:52, 5:47, and 5:58, respectively. My complaints about Warren's tardiness had gone exactly nowhere. Apparently, being the owner's son entitled him to act like a human rug burn. I might have simply walked out, whether he showed up or not, except the first rule at Diamond Trucking was that the dispatch desk, the lifeline to 46 rigs crisscrossing the country, carrying time-sensitive fresh produce, had to be staffed 24/7. And I simply couldn't afford to lose this job. It paid $18 an hour and didn't make me contribute a dime for a no-deductible health care plan, a perk that was worth its weight in free well-baby checkups now that we had Alex. Admittedly, being a trucking company dispatcher at age 31 wasn't the career I anticipated having when I graduated from the University of Virginia with a summa cum laude seal on my diploma and plans to do meaningful work for a socially responsible organization. But those high-minded goals had collided rather abruptly with the realities of my graduation year, 2009, which has the distinction of being the absolute worst moment in the history of modern America to have entered the job market. I compounded my horrific sense of timing with a degree in English literature, which meant I was articulate, urbane, and virtually unhirable. It took 5 years and 1,000 failed cover letters, 5 years of either unemployment or slinging lattes at Starbucks, before I finally landed this gig. And I wasn't going to give it up, even if it meant Warren Plotz's chronic tardiness gave me angina every other week. It was 5:54 as I neared the light for Statler Boulevard, which forms a semicircle around the eastern side of Stanton, a quaint city of about 25,000 in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Most of the time I enjoyed Stanton's slower pace, except when it came in the form of people who were leaving 6 car lengths between them and the next vehicle, forcing me to dance between lanes to get around them. I knew, from hard experience, that it was exactly 6 minutes to Mrs. Ferncliff's house from Statler. As long as I made it through that light with the clock still at 5:54, I would be fine. Barely. Then, when I was still about 100 yards away, the light went yellow. The wait for the signal at Statler was, for reasons known only to the light-timing gods, notoriously long. If I stopped, there was no way I'd make it in time. Mrs. Ferncliff would fire us, and we'd be stuck trying to find new childcare. That, I already knew, was hopeless. Ben was a grad student who was given only a small stipend, and growing up poor and black in Alabama hadn't exactly endowed him with family money, so we couldn't afford any of the fancy daycare centers that promised all children would master quantum theory by age 3. That left us with in-home settings, most of which seemed to be run by chain smokers, inattentive great-grandmothers, or people who thought there was nothing wrong with a baby inhaling the occasional lead paint chip. I stomped down on the accelerator. The light turned red a few nanoseconds before I crossed over the solid white line. No matter, I was through. I breathed out heavily. Then I saw the blue lights of a Stanton City police car flashing in my rearview mirror. One traffic ticket, and 23 minutes later, I was in a frenzy as I pulled into Mrs. Ferncliff's short driveway. I grabbed the ticket in the hopes I could use it to convince Der Kaiser to show me some leniency, then hurried up her front steps and grasped the handle of the front door. It was locked, which was strange. Ordinarily, Mrs. Ferncliff left her door open. She didn't like to leave children unattended to answer it. I pressed the doorbell button and waited. 15 seconds. 30 seconds. I pressed the button again. "Mrs. Ferncliff, it's Melanie Barrick," I said in a loud voice, knowing she was somewhere inside, peeved at me. "I'm sorry I'm late. I got held up at work again, and then on the way here I was in such a hurry I got pulled over. And I would have called, but I can't find my phone." Pathetic. I sounded utterly pathetic. I couldn't say I was the worst parent in history. My own parents, who gave me up for adoption when I was 9, cemented their claim on that title long ago. But I had to be close.
I'm sorry, okay? I continued. I'm so, so sorry. Could you please open the door?
There was still no answer. Maybe she was just gathering Alex's things, which she would shove through the door, along with the baby. And our contract, with the 6 o'clock termination clause highlighted. After another minute of standing on that front porch, had that cost me another dollar? I was starting to get a little angry. How long was the silent treatment going to last? I pounded on the door with the butt of my hand.
Mrs. Ferncliff, please, I said. I'm sorry I'm late. Very late. I'm sorry I'm a terrible mother. I'm sorry for everything.
Still no response. Finally, Mrs. Ferncliff's stern voice came through the door.
Go away. Go away or I'm calling the police.
Okay, fine. Just let me have Alex and I'll be on my way. And then Mrs. Ferncliff said something that shot a few gigawatts of electricity to my gut.
Alex is gone.
I took a sharp, involuntary breath.
What? Social Services has him.
The charge was now spiking from my toes to my brain. I knew Mrs. Ferncliff was strict, but this was pathological.
You turned him over to Social Services because I was 20 minutes late?
I howled.
I didn't do anything of the sort. They came and took him a few hours ago.
What?
Why? What the?
You can ask Social Services. Now go away.
I don't want you on my property.
Mrs. Ferncliff, why did Social Services take Alex? I have no idea what's going on.
Good, she spat. They told me all about you. I hope they get that child as far away from you as possible.
What are you talking about?
I'm calling 911 now.
Would you please just have a rational conversation with me? No answer.
Please, Mrs. Ferncliff, please!
But she had stopped answering. I could hear her on the other side of the door, because she wanted to be heard, loudly telling the Stanton police she had an intruder banging on her door and was very afraid for her safety. Feeling like I had no choice, and knowing the ever-unyielding Mrs. Ferncliff was unlikely to change her mind, I departed from her porch and returned to my car. As I sat in the driver's seat, I knew I had to find Alex, but I was too dazed to order my thoughts as to how I'd do it. They told me all about you. I hope they get that child as far away from you as possible. What did that even mean? Alex wasn't malnourished. He didn't have bruises. He wasn't abused in any way. The only thing I could think was that someone had called Social Services on me. When you grow up in foster care, as I did, you learn there is a certain type of person, a mean, nasty, vindictive subspecies of subhuman who will use Social Services as a weapon, calling in anonymous tips out of spite against neighbors, co-workers, or anyone they truly hate. I didn't think I had anyone like that in my life. Warren Plotz was too busy oversleeping for that kind of treachery. I didn't have a feud with any of my neighbors. I didn't have enemies. At least, not that I knew of. I made myself back down the driveway and pull out on the street, just so Mrs. Ferncliff couldn't sic a police officer on me. As I did so, a panic lashed into me. Alex is gone. Social Services has him.
For as much as I tried to tell myself this was a misunderstanding, I knew better. Social services didn't just swoop in and tear someone's baby away because a child care provider was angry about tardiness. It did so only when it had a reason, or at least when it thought it had a reason. And it didn't turn the baby back over without a reason either. That's one of the things I learned during my time as a ward of the state. But the bigger lesson of my childhood, one that was now bouncing back at me like some ancient echo, was something one of my foster sisters once told me. I had been fuming about being ripped away from a solid, comfortable placement so I could be sent, for no apparent reason, to a group home. "This is a disaster," I moaned. "Honey, this is the foster care system," she replied. "Disaster is always closer than you know." Chapter 3. As I drove away, a thin sweat had broken out on my body. I was relying on muscle memory to steer the car. I had no sensation of being in control of my own limbs. I turned on the avenue outside Mrs. Ferncliffe's street. The double yellow line appeared blurred, either by perspiration or tears. I wanted to call Ben, desperately. But in addition to his research and the two classes where he worked as a teaching assistant, he also had a part-time job tutoring in the Learning Skills Center at James Madison University. He never picked up when he was with his students. There was also the matter of my missing phone. No amount of rooting around in the usual spots, the table by the front door, the diaper bag, the couch cushions, and so on, had unearthed it. The only other person I could bother at a time like this was Marcus Peterson. He had been my manager at Starbucks, and was now just a dear friend, the kind of guy who would drop everything to help me. The only problem was, his contact info was stored in my phone. Really, who knew their friends' phone numbers off the top of their head anymore? There was no one else. The rest of my friends were either too far away, or I wasn't in touch with them on a regular basis. As for our parents, Ben's lived in Alabama, and mine were non-existent. That's one of the harsh facts of growing up in foster care. When things go sideways, you don't have a family you can rely on to keep you upright. With no real plan, I drove toward social services, desperately hoping Alex was still there, or that someone working late might know his whereabouts. The nearest office was just up the road in Verona, at the Government Center complex. Shenandoah Valley Social Services was one of two agencies I had come to know during my youth. It was, as social services offices tended to be, an austere box of a building with no windows, sort of like a warehouse, which fit. There are a lot of times when, as a child being shuttled around between placements, you really do feel like you're being warehoused. At 6:45 on a Tuesday night, the parking lot had just one vehicle in it, a small Chevy. Maybe its driver would still be inside and could tell me something. The employee entrance was on the left side of the building. There was a small light, housed in a protective cage, above the door. It had no buzzer or intercom. Not knowing what else to do, I pounded on the door with the side of my fist. At first, this didn't accomplish much more than giving me a sore hand. I am 5'5" and a twiggy 120 pounds, hardly a threat to a solid steel door. Still, I was giving it all I had, turning that boxy building into one big bass drum. That Chevy driver had to hear me. I thumped the door in a steady rhythm. 4 hits, a rest, then 4 more hits. Boom, 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 boom. Wait. Boom, 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 boom. Wait. Finally. "Can I help you?" It was a woman, just on the other side of the door. Yes, thank you, thank you, I said, aware I sounded overwrought. Someone from social services came and took my son out of daycare today, and I wanted to talk to someone and straighten this whole thing out.
I was trying to present myself as something other than a woman who was rapidly becoming unhinged. There was a pause.
No one called you or visited you? She said.
She asked like this was unusual. Against protocol, even. And it was unusual, wasn't it? You couldn't just rip a child away from his mother without any kind of notice.
No, no one did, I said, relieved, because even the question made me feel like this woman might be reasonable, or at least willing to talk with me. Okay, hang on. What's your name?
Melanie Barrick. My son's name is Alex. They took him from Ida Ferncliff's house on Churchville Avenue, and I don't even know why.
Okay, let me make a call. I'll be right back.
Thank you, I said. Thank you so much.
I stood there, staring at the door. The temperature was probably in the low 40s, and I hadn't bothered grabbing my jacket before I left work. It didn't matter. My heart was working so hard, I couldn't feel the cold. My hope was that, right now, they were examining Alex with his chubby knees, his ready smile, and his ever-alert blue-gray eyes. They were realizing he could not possibly have been abused. They had probably tried to call me, but we don't have a landline, and my phone, missing and probably dead from lack of battery, had gone straight to voicemail. Right now, this was all being straightened out. It would take a little time, yes. Everything with social services took time. But Alex would be back home with us for the evening. He would sleep in his own crib, wake up for his middle-of-the-night feeding, the whole thing. Our normal routine. From the other side of the door, I heard a tentative,
"Hello?"
"Yes, hi, I'm here," I said, leaning toward the door like that was getting me closer to Alex.
"I spoke to my supervisor about your case. She says you'll have to come back in the morning."
Something in my head exploded.
"What?"
I said, and not because I hadn't heard her.
"I'm sorry, that's what she told me. She said they would be able to tell you about the procedure from there."
The procedure? We were now part of a procedure?
"But where is he?" I asked.
"I'm sorry, I can't tell you that."
"No, wait," I said desperately. "You can't just take my son and then not tell me anything. I'm his mother. I have rights. This is crazy. Can't you at least open the door and talk to me?"
"I'm sorry, ma'am," she said, now more firm. "You'll have to come back in the morning."
"No, no," I screamed. "This isn't right. You've made a mistake, a huge mistake. I know someone has made a complaint or something, but they're lying. They're lying to you. People do that, you know. They use you guys to get back at people. You have to know that."
I was no longer worried that I sounded like a lunatic.
"Come back in the morning, ma'am," the woman said. "I have to go now. Can I please talk to your supervisor myself? I'm not a bad mother. I would never hurt my baby. Just look at him. He's fine. Can't you see that? Please."
There was no answer.
I pounded the door again. "Please," I said. "Please help me."
For the next 5 or 10 minutes, I reiterated this plea and other versions of it, getting increasingly hysterical. I knew too much about the child welfare system, having experienced its shortcomings firsthand. I had seen how its best intentions could be twisted by the intransigence and senselessness of what was basically a broken bureaucracy. I had met too many shifty adults who took advantage of the lack of oversight, whether it was the chronically lazy caseworker doing as little work as possible to keep her job, or the foster family who saw only dollar signs when it took in a new child. And yes, they were the minority, but even the good people were being thrust into this thing that was too big, too clumsy, and too overstressed by having to deal with society's collective dysfunction. It was almost inevitable something that unwieldy would create as many problems as it solved. People who were enmeshed in that world called it simply the system. And it was really the perfect term for something so cold, complex, and ultimately impersonal. Once you were in it, you lost some part of your humanity. Your family became a file to be passed around from one harried, underpaid, overworked civil servant to another. I had come too far from my own splintered childhood and worked too hard to be free of that madness, to get caught up in it again. This wasn't happening. Couldn't be happening. Not to Alex. Because I knew how it worked from here. Once you were in the system, there was no easy way out. Its collective machinery acted like a giant steel maw, trapping you between its sharpened incisors, tearing another chunk out of you every time you jerked or squirmed. No matter what the law said, every parent who got reported to social services was guilty until proven innocent. The caseworkers either came in thinking that way or they learned it in a hurry. I saw how it had been for my own parents. Every time someone from social services dealt with me, it would be with the quiet assumption I was basically scum. They would pretend to seek my input. They would talk with me about partnering and collaborating. All the while, they would be calling the shots, dealing cards off a deck that was far too short. Already, someone had made a decision about where Alex would spend the night. Someone else, some stranger, some foster parent or group home administrator I had never met, someone who couldn't possibly care about my child as much as I did, was now holding Alex. Or not. Maybe he was lying in a crib, screaming from hunger, or stewing in a dirty diaper. Or worse. And I could cry about it, or rage against the heavens, or throw myself to the ground in agony. And it wouldn't matter. I sagged against the door, bawling, then slumped down to the cold concrete beneath my feet. The woman was gone. And so was Alex. Chapter 4. Everyone has a vice. For some people, it was cigarettes, or booze, or porn. For Amy Kay, it was less destructive, but also somehow more embarrassing. Dancing with the Stars, the reality television show, which paired eye-candy celebrities with hard-bodied professional dancers in competitions of exhilarating meaninglessness, was her drug, her comfort food, her obsession. Well, one of her obsessions, anyway. No one down at the Augusta County Courthouse would have guessed that the chief deputy Commonwealth's attorney, whose knowledge of the law even intimidated some of the judges, loved to spend her evenings curled up on the couch under a blanket watching this drivel, or that she sometimes wept when people lost, and always when they won, or that her dog, Butch, who was supposedly not allowed on the couch, could be reliably found tucked under the blanket with her. Amy just didn't give up those kinds of details, or really any personal details, about herself. She had seen too many times when people used those kinds of things against a prosecutor. The image she worked hard to present was all about competence and efficiency. She kept her dark hair short. She didn't wear makeup. She dressed conservatively. No one knew her exact age, 42, if she was married, she was, to a man, or if she had children. She didn't, and didn't particularly miss them. The most they knew about her was that she played a mean third base for the sheriff's office's team in the local co-ed softball rec league. This, naturally, led to rumors she was a lesbian. She didn't care. What happened at the courthouse wasn't supposed to be about personalities. It was about the law. And within the law, the individual who represented the people of the Commonwealth had a certain role to play. It was more than a job. It was a sworn duty. And she intended to execute it to her utmost ability. At least until Dancing with the Stars came on. Then the law could wait. The newest season featured an Olympian who had been semi-tarnished by a tabloid scandal that had boosted his Q rating higher than any gold medal ever could have. He was the de facto bad boy. Amy was rooting for him, mostly because he was constantly taking off his shirt. His abs were sensational. He was now in the semifinals, and she was all set to cheer him to greater glory, with Butch at her side and a bowl of popcorn in her lap. Then, just as the title sequence began, her phone rang. She frowned at it, sitting on the coffee table in front of her. The caller ID showed the name Aaron Dansby. Dansby was the duly elected Commonwealth's attorney for Augusta County, which technically made him Amy's boss, even if the reality was more complicated. To be sure, Dansby had graduated law school and passed the bar exam, but he was an attorney only in the titular sense. In every other way, he was a politician. From his carefully styled hair to his plastic grin, from his model gorgeous wife, she was a former Estee Lauder saleswoman, to his distinguished pedigree. His father had been Commonwealth's attorney, then state senator, then gone back to being Commonwealth's attorney until Aaron was old enough to take the job. His grandfather had been a congressman. His great-grandfather had been governor. Aaron Dansby's sights were said to be set at least that high. Only 33, he had been identified by party elders as having a great future. He was just marking time as Commonwealth's attorney. The practice of law was little more than a means to an end. The phone rang again. She was tempted to ignore it. Part of the recruiting pitch that lured her down to Augusta County from Fairfax County, where she had been a lower-level deputy in a large office, was that Dansby was a newbie prosecutor who would need time to knock off his training wheels, and that, in the meantime, she would get a lot of say-so as second-in-command in a small office. 3 years later, she was still running the place on a day-to-day basis. Dansby was almost entirely indifferent to routine matters. Only the high-profile cases interested him. In those, he sat first chair, so he could get credit for the victory with the media, which heedlessly burnished his boy wonder legend. Amy, sitting second chair, still did all the work. Another ring. The only issue with ignoring a call from Dansby is that he only phoned when a case had the potential to be a big one. The title sequence was ending. The show was about to begin. The DVR was recording it. Some dances just had to be enjoyed a second or third time. But she liked to watch live. One more ring and Aaron Dansby would slip into the sweet vacuum of voicemail, which is exactly where he belonged. Except Amy had that sense of duty. And the knowledge that if she didn't answer, Aaron Dansby might make a mess she'd just have to clean up. In one quick motion, she jabbed the pause button on the DVR, then tapped her phone. Amy Kay.
Amy, it's Aaron.
What's up? Are you busy? He asked.
A little, actually.
This will just take a second, he said, because he was congenitally incapable of taking a hint. I wanted to give you a heads up. There was a big coke bust this afternoon out on Desper Hollow Road.
Okay.
Big as in half a kilo.
Wow,
Amy said, sitting up a little. In Fairfax County, which had D.C. right next door, 500 grams of cocaine wouldn't get as much notice. Here, in the sleepy Shenandoah Valley, it was a startling number.
I know. I already leaked it to the newsleader. They're putting it on the front page tomorrow. I'm going to leak it to TV next so they can get it on at 11. Sheriff said he'll lay out the bags for me. It'll make for great visuals.
Dansby still didn't understand that it wasn't considered a leak when the media outlet was either quoting you by name or putting you on camera. He also didn't realize that by diving in front of the cameras, consistently upstaging Sheriff Jason Powers and his deputies, Dansby was sowing discontent in the ranks that would be harvested someday. Amy had close working relationships with several of the deputies. They were all waiting for the day when the guy they derisively referred to as Dapper Dansby got his.
That's not even the best part,
Dansby continued, and Amy cringed, because there was no best part about a criminal conspiracy to distribute narcotics.
The woman who had all this stuff, she's a mom. The guys at the newsleader are already calling her Coke Mom. I think this thing is going to have some legs. It's got viral potential on social media. And TV will love it.
I'm sure, Amy said, eyeing her own TV, wondering what she had already missed.
But after you get your FaceTime, don't you think we should give this thing to the feds? That's a lot of coke.
There was no specific amount of drugs that automatically made a case federal. It was up to the local Commonwealth's attorney. But half a kilo was usually more than enough. Larger amounts of product indicated larger distribution networks, which almost always crossed state lines.
I know, Dansby said, but I want to keep this one. I think this is going to end up grabbing a lot of eyeballs, and I want us to get points for it.
Dansby was constantly referencing points, as if the electorate kept a giant scoreboard somewhere. It made Amy want to hit him with a frying pan.
Plus, he added, she's white.
Amy felt her eyes bulge.
What does that matter?
Well, after Mookie Myers, you know.
Demetrius Mookie Myers was the biggest bust of Dansby's 3+ year tenure, the largest cocaine dealer the Shenandoah Valley had seen since the bad old days of the late 80s. The case was now in the early stages of the appeals process, but it had been a solid win for the prosecution and had clearly enhanced young Dansby's reputation.
No, I don't know, Amy said.
There's talk in the black community. We only go hard after the black dealers, Dansby said. I want to make an example out of this woman. Show everyone we're equal opportunity hardasses. Grand jury meets on Friday, right? What do you think of going for direct indictment?
Direct indictment was a kind of prosecutorial shortcut. If a suspect was arrested on a normal warrant, the case first went to general district court for arraignment, counsel determination, and a bond hearing. 2 months later, it got a preliminary hearing where a judge certified it to a grand jury, which then handed down an indictment. Direct indictment skipped all those steps. Often used in drug cases, it took the matter straight to the grand jury. The clerk of court then issued a capias, which resulted in the defendant's arrest. The only risk was that until the grand jury met, the defendant was not in custody. For that reason, Amy preferred to use direct indictment only when suspects didn't yet know the law was onto them, Not after a search warrant had already been executed.
"You're sure you want to give this woman 2 days to take off?" Amy asked.
"I've got to think anyone with that much cocaine lying around has enough cash stashed away to disappear for as long as she needs to."
"She's not going anywhere," Dansby said with his usual breezy certainty. "She's got a kid. Social Services grabbed him already. She'll stick around as long as we've got the kid."
"I hope you're right."
"Don't worry. We got this. Anyhow, I told Powers you were going to start working on this in the morning. If we're going to put this before a grand jury on Friday, we've got to get cracking."
Amy felt her spine straighten. "I can't. I've got that interview with Daphne Hasper tomorrow morning."
"Daphne Hasper?"
"I sent you a memo about her," she said. "She's one of the Whisper victims." This was Amy's other obsession, the one that actually mattered. A series of unsolved sexual assaults in the valley over nearly 2 decades. The link between them was that the perpetrator only ever whispered at his victims. There were at least 8 cases, but perhaps as many as 25 or more. No one really knew because no one, besides Amy, had ever dug into the case that hard. Dansby usually reacted to Amy's mentions of the case with anything from apathy to antipathy, depending on his mood. This time it was the former.
"Oh, that," Dansby said. "That can wait."
"No, it can't. Not until we get that bastard in prison."
"This is more important right now.
You getting a quick scalp for the TV news and some more of those mythical points that only you seem to be counting is more important than incarcerating a man who breaks into women's houses at night and rapes them?"
"Don't be overdramatic.
Don't be an asshole." He paused. He preferred conversations that stayed on script and speeches he could read off a teleprompter. The force of Amy's words had caused Butch to lift his head, which was now tilted.
"I think," Dansby said in a measured tone, "Coke Mom is more of a priority."
"I'm glad you think so, but I'm not going to cancel this interview."
"Except when you say interview, you really mean re-interview, yes? This is a woman who has already talked to the cops."
"When the incident happened, yes, but they didn't know about the other cases then. And no one has talked to her in years."
"If it's been years, then you can put it off a few days."
"No, I can't. This woman moved out of town a long time ago. She's only back for a few days visiting family. I have to get her while I can. You have no idea how hard it was to track her down and then convince her to meet with me."
"I'm sure you can put her on the shelf for a little while."
"For the 12th time, I can't," Amy said. "And I won't."
"I told Jason you would be talking to one of his deputies in the morning."
"Great. Jason's deputy will still be available to me in the afternoon. This woman might not be. I'm not postponing the interview." Amy was nearly yelling into the phone. Butch, who was a notorious conflict avoider, looked at her nervously. Dansby finally started fighting back.
"You know you work at the pleasure of the Commonwealth's attorney, right? I could fire you any time I wanted. I'm ordering you to work on Coke Mom tomorrow morning."
"You're ordering me, Aaron? Oh, that's rich. That's really rich. Let me ask you something. When's the last time you prosecuted a DUI?" There was silence on the other end of the line.
"Oh, that's right. Never," Amy said.
"So how about this? We've got a bumper crop of drunks scheduled for General District Court on Thursday. 3 or 4, as I recall. How about I let you prosecute them instead of doing your job for you? Because I think at least 2 of the defendants have private attorneys, and you can be sure the moment they see you, they won't even think about pleading it out. They'll smell blood, and they will pick apart every morsel of evidence you try to put forward if you even know how to present it properly. You'll lose your breathalyzer test so fast it'll make your head spin." Would that pleasure you, Mr. Commonwealth's attorney?
Stop being...
Oh, just wait. I haven't even told you what you might call the best part. I'll make sure to tip off the news leader, or, sorry, leak it to the news leader, so they know to have a reporter there. They usually get those things online pretty fast. By Thursday afternoon, everyone will know Aaron Dansby lets drunks walk free. How does that sound?
You wouldn't dare.
I would. And I will. Try me. Amy could practically hear Dansby's butt smacking the wall she had backed him up against.
You'll call Jason tomorrow morning. If his deputy can't meet with you until tomorrow afternoon, well, whatever, he said, trying to save face. And you better damn well be ready on Friday. This thing has to be airtight.
Fine, she said. Then she hung up. Butch was still staring at her.
I know, I shouldn't let him get me that upset, she said. But he's a jerk.
Butch licked his nose.
I should really stop propping him up the way I do, she said.
Except they both knew she never would. She placed the sanctity of the law far above whatever satisfaction she would get from watching a show pony like Dansby get mud on his ribbons. Butch put his head back down. He wanted to get back to snuggling. Amy glanced toward the television, where the title sequence was still frozen, beckoning her to cast off her worldly burdens.
Sorry, boy, she said. I'm just not feeling it.
She rose from the couch, eliciting a groan from Butch, and walked into her home office, where several drawers of a filing cabinet were now packed tight with material from this case. It had started with an offhand comment from a young sheriff's deputy a few months after Amy had arrived in Augusta County. There had been a sexual assault in Weir's Cave. A young woman had been attacked by a masked, knife-wielding assailant. His entire monologue, which included a lot of please, thank you, and I'm sorry, had come out in a whisper.
Huh, that's weird, the deputy had said. There was another guy in Stewart's draft a few months ago who whispered at a girl. You think it's the same guy?
Amy checked on the Stewart's draft case, but hadn't been sure there was a connection. The assailant was described as being both older and larger. Nevertheless, Amy filed it away. When a whispering rapist struck again a few months later, she started asking around. One of the older detectives told her he could remember three or four such cases. When she asked why he had never looked into a connection between the cases, all he could say was,
"Don't most rapists whisper?"
So Amy dove in. It was her good fortune that Jason Powers had been sheriff for 7 years, and that his father, Alan, had been sheriff for 24 years before that. The records were all there. So was the evidence. Amy went through every unsolved sexual assault case she could find, battling dust mites and brushing away cobwebs during long hours in the file room. She worked at night, when her husband, who was a chef at one of Stanton's many restaurants, was gone anyway. It was a long process. But slowly, methodically, she unearthed evidence of a serial rapist on the loose. The first case she found involving a man who whispered to his victim was in 1987, but she dismissed that as an outlier, unconnected to the current-day cases. There was also one in 1997. She wasn't sure about that one. He was described as talking in a low voice, which may or may not have been the same as a whisper. There was nothing the next 5 years, but then there were three hits during a 9-month span at the end of 2002 and early 2003. Then nothing until 2005. Then there was one in 2007 and another in 2008. Just when it seemed the man was picking up steam again. There was nothing until 2010. Then he began to strike with more frequency. The cases were separated by a measure of months, not years. She had come up with 20 cases over the previous 7 years, plus the 7 that came before 2010, not counting the 1987 outlier. They fit roughly the same pattern. A masked, glove-wearing white male who was described as being somewhere between 5'9" and 6'2", and anywhere between his late teens and his mid-40s. The age had crept up through the years, but it still varied widely, had broken into the home of a woman who lived alone. His assaults mostly took place in the early morning. He threatened her with a knife or gun until she acquiesced to undress and let him penetrate her. Yet he was also unfailingly polite, speaking to his victims in a voice that was later described as a hush, a murmur, or a whisper. And he never actually used either weapon. To the profilers, this made him a classic case. He was a power reassurance rapist, sometimes known as the gentleman rapist, who operated under the delusion that these encounters were somehow romantic. For him, stalking a victim was a twisted kind of courtship, the beginnings of what he saw as a relationship. If the victim resisted or found a way to shatter that romantic spell, by vomiting, peeing on him, or screaming, the power reassurance rapist often broke off the attack. Some power reassurance rapists were actually caught because they couldn't resist contacting their victim later. After all, in the bizarre worldview of the power reassurance rapist, she was like a girlfriend. This one was too cagey for that. Amy had, so far, uncovered 8 cases where the DNA matched one another. That had been a long, hard slog. Forget the television crime dramas, where DNA test results were as readily available and as quickly produced as items on the McDonald's dollar menu. In the real world, DNA tests took time. The state lab in Roanoke, where Amy sent evidence, usually returned results in 5 or 6 months. Many of the earlier cases did not have DNA associated with them because DNA tests were even less readily available back then. Amy was slowly trying to correct that. There were also cases where no DNA had been recovered. The rapist never used a condom, but frequently ejaculated on, not inside of, his victims. He was then careful about cleaning up, often taking their bedsheets and clothing with him. Other times, the victim had been unable to resist the urge to take a shower after the assault, or had waited a day or more to report the crime, at which point the physical evidence was gone. The other chief obstacle was that if the DNA didn't match someone already in the system, there was no mechanism in place that automatically compared the DNA in otherwise disconnected, unsolved cases. It had to be done by hand, case by case. That's how the perpetrator had been able to go undetected for so long. Based on the scattered pattern of the assaults, Amy's theory was that the assailant only occasionally visited Augusta County at first, then decided to move there. Perhaps he was a traveling salesman, or a construction worker, or a long-haul trucker. After she had gotten her 3rd DNA match, Amy had presented the case to Dansby, saying they should take it to the media. If there was a rapist on the loose, the citizens of Augusta County had a right to know about it. Besides, the publicity could help them crack the case. Someone might come forward with information or a better description of the assailant. Dansby had calmly listened to Amy talk until he finally realized she not only couldn't definitively ID the perp, she didn't even have a suspect. At that point, he had a toddler-like meltdown.
"Are you trying to ruin my career?" he asked. "We can't leak it to the media unless we already have the guy."
To Dansby, it was the sort of thing that reflected poorly on law enforcement generally, and him specifically, a major menace to public safety at large, mocking the authorities' inability to apprehend him. This resulted in a huge fight, and eventually a compromise. Amy could keep working on the case as long as it didn't interfere with her other responsibilities.